Shades on this 11th of September. I'm your host, Gia Scott. And before we get started on the topic of the month, I did have a few things I wanted to remind you about. There's a survey on my website, and I'm still taking responses, so go to www.giascott.com and send it in. Be proactive and make the show what it is that you want it to be. The second thing is, we will be giving away something this month, and you don't want to miss your chance. And I definitely recommend reading the website, which is a huge hint, folks. I want the winner to be someone who has been listening to the show, even without any contest, to win something. So, it's definitely slanted to the listener's advantage. And now, with another one of my not-so-smooth change of topics, we're back to this month, and we have focused on a theme of spirituality. We started off last week with our discussion as we attempted to define what spirituality was. And thinking back, I don't think we ever even did succeed in defining it. We were more focused on what it was not. Still, eliminating some things does help to start to define a very complex concept. There is so much that we can't explain or define. A few weeks ago, I broke a molar badly and had it pulled about 2 weeks ago now. Now, I've never had a fear of dentists or dental procedures, and I was even a dental assistant for a while. But I'm afraid I can no longer make that statement. To keep this story short, we will just say that things didn't go very well, and a few days later, I had a dry socket that required treatment. Last weekend, that too familiar pain started again, and I was not looking forward to another treatment at all. I happened to say something to a friend in an online discussion group about the situation, and he offered to fix it for me with an acquaintance's help. Now, I don't know how they did it. I don't know what they did. I also have to confess that it can't be the placebo effect, because I honestly didn't think he could do a thing to ease the pain, let alone actually fix the problem. But shortly after their attempt, I went to bed and the pain vanished, and I've not had a twinge since then. I have to wonder, could they fix other things? How does this work? What is it that they even are doing? I would like to hear about other people's experiences with non-medical healings, so please email me with your accounts at gscott@gmail.com. And returning to spirituality, today is 9/11, an infamous date symbolic of terrorism to most Americans. It was a day that changed our lives forever in many ways that we never expected that day. Irregardless of your political or conspiratorial theories, it definitely had a profound effect. In some ways, I believe it acted as a trigger or catalyst for the awakening of spirituality in the United States. So often, culture, language, and religion divide this world, and through spirituality, there is a unity, a singularity, even when it's only fleetingly achieved by the individual. I truly and deeply believe that it is in spirituality that the answers that I need, that every one of you listening tonight needs to find. I hope that each week, as you tune into the Dawn of Shades, that the discussion here helps you to think, to look within yourself, to find the answers that you are seeking, to find that personal illumination for your world. Now, I hear some of you going, as I say that, and you look at the upcoming programs on my website, www.gscott.com. That's okay. Maybe every show is not about being spiritually introspective, and sometimes it may actually be more facetious than factual. I'm not perfect, nor have I ever met a perfect person, so I have to confess I need the leavening of humor in my life, too. A bit of playful time is a good thing, I believe. Now, today, I have brought a guest with a slight shift in focus, Ken Eaglefeather. The bio I posted on my website for him reads, concurrent with his apprenticeship to Don Juan, Ken obtained a degree in education and mass communications. He later served on staff of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, which is part of the Edgar Casey legacy, and the Monroe Institute, founded by Robert Monroe, a pioneer in using sound technology to facilitate the exploration of consciousness. A former vice president of sales and marketing for a publishing company, he is currently communications director for a medical science research organization. He is also the author of Toltec Dreaming, On the Toltec Path, Traveling with Power, Tracking Freedom, and The Dream of Vixen Tor. He lives in Richmond, Virginia. Now, Ken, I would like to welcome you to the Dawn of Shades. I realize that this bio is very brief and doesn't really say much about who you are and what you are writing about, so can you help me and the audience out? Fill in the blanks and the spaces between the lines a little bit.
Well, thanks for having me here first. I'm glad to be here. That's a pretty wide open question. Some of the background being that after I returned home from Vietnam back in the early 70s, I was suffering from some internal distress, of which an array of doctors weren't very successful in helping me find remedy, find cure. And it was through the book of one Carlos Castaneda, who wrote Journey to Ixtlan, which was in another title, was his doctoral dissertation in anthropology. His work is quite controversial, with some people thinking he's very fraudulent. I take the opposite end of the thing. I think he was a masterful anthropologist. And it was by using that book, and each chapter was a lesson on, say, learning how to run through the desert at night without damage to the physical body, different ways of shifting to look at the world, getting out of normal habitual patterns of perceiving the world, and using death as an advisor, actually, so that you measure your steps governed by the knowledge and awareness that at some point, be it 1 second or 100 years from now, each of us is going to die. And using that not as an encumbrance, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die, but as focus on how to bring oneself to life. And so while I was in the hospital, I engaged that book. I started practicing the techniques, and that is what delivered me to healing later, leaving the military and not looking back since. In terms of, you mentioned the odds against having a placebo effect and whatnot, and different forms of non-medical healing. We're talking about states of mind here. And what that means is one immediate daily application is to help either restore health or maintain health. And the crux of the system he wrote about, which is a form of shamanism, and shamanism is perhaps the widest practice philosophy in the world, typically given to non-technological cultures. However, over the last 20 years, that's changed dramatically, where there are, I hesitate to say followers, practitioners of the shamanic philosophy in the corporate boardroom, in medical offices, pretty much darn near anywhere, simply because it's a very wholesome, centered philosophy that allows you to achieve balance and harmony in your daily life, and that's probably the bottom line of it. In this particular branch of shamanism, derived from the Toltecs of 5,000 years ago in the central areas of Mexico, The core of their teachings centered on the energy body. And here we're getting to states of mind. And the energy body is a natural aspect of all humans. We all have one. It extends a couple feet above the head, below the feet, and outward all the way around. It kind of looks like an egg. Over the course of the evolution, it's gone from a more football shape, eventually inching its way toward that of a sphere. And it is the theory of the energy body that the energy within it determines everything that the individual sees, hears, perceives, thinks, experiences. That is the determinant on how we get on in this world. And so that's the core of it, and that when you start looking into that terms, those terms, a change in frequency within the energy body will produce a change from disease to healing, or vice versa.
Most of us find the concept of healing ourselves, really fascinating, because, face it, you look at the statistics, we're falling apart really, really fast. In addition to the general population of the United States is beginning to age now. There's more older people than there are younger people. As we age, we don't heal as fast as we used to. Old injuries come back and say, "Hi, how you doing?" And want to get reintroduced and so forth and so on. So healing yourself would become much, much better than swallowing a wide variety of pills every morning.
Indeed, yeah. The American Medical Association just released a paper from the intern, their archives. Oh my gosh, one of the Archives of Internal Medicine, stating from the period 1998 to 2005, serious adverse effects, events, drug-related, have increased 2.6-fold. And the senior citizens are the most subject to that, and they're calling for reforms on different quarters in terms of how trials are done, how pharmaceuticals are looked at. I think the pharmaceutical industry has reached a plateau where they, you know, this attack and kill modality of pharmaceuticals has really reached a plateau. It's done some marvelous, marvelous things, but it really can't proceed anymore. We need more gentle, effective, and safe therapies.
Well, you know, that's a huge concern for us. We've had all these recent issues with drugs being pulled off the market because of serious, life-threatening side effects. I know in my own personal case, I've developed more and more allergies. If I take an antibiotic, it's like, wait and see what's going to happen, because, you know, the next few hours could be quite intriguing. So it's Russian roulette for me if I'm ever sick enough that does require an antibiotic.
Yeah, we've taken a track to where we are a generation, and, you know, three generations sandwiched together here, that for the first time we don't have natural defenses because of immunization. And that's fine. I'm not suggesting that's not a good thing. But we're not, in the antibiotics, we're actually weaning ourselves away from being able to handle infection and weaning ourselves toward drug-resistant strains. And this is quite the development in the evolution of the species. We're in serious trouble.
We're in serious trouble on a number of facets, it seems.
Yeah, right.
You know, we're sort of headed on a roller coaster towards disaster, and there is no brakes on this particular train.
Right.
You know, and you know, you recently, the most recent book, I understand, is called Toltec Dreaming. And, you know, can you tell us a little bit about what that book is about?
Sure. That, it takes as the initial premise the energy body. And it's divided, for practical purposes of instruction, into the right and left side, simple enough. But as a friend once told me, there are two kinds of people in the world, those who divide everything into two and those who don't. And in this case, it's a very practical, functional model. So the right and left side pertain toward what is known about the world and what is not known, but yet can be known. And so dreaming in the nighttime variety of, which is a very disciplined, controlled endeavor, where the person goes lucid in their dreams, which means simply the person is woken up inside their dream and can control it as though they were physically awake. And then the next step from that would be the out-of-body experience, of which the three classic defining features of an out-of-body experience is that consciousness is localized away from the physical body. So you're just aware of someplace distant.
Uh-huh.
And that form, you tend to carry form with it. So usually you're a human shape, simply because that's the habit of perception. The longer a person is out, or the more fluent they become with the skill, the form tends to change to a sphere, and then later just to a point of awareness.
Uh-huh.
And a third feature is it carries emotion with it. It carries that sense of aliveness. So for remote viewing, for example, is you can become exceedingly aware, scientifically aware, of remote places or quantum mechanics, but yet there is dry, there's no emotion carried with it. It's a matter of fact and abstract, where with the out-of-body, there's an emotional aspect to it. And so those are different levels of dreaming. The idea being that there are ways to step into the areas that are not known, but which have the capacity to become known, to explore. And when the person comes out of dreaming, they work to integrate, in a true shamanic fashion, they work to integrate those experiences into their daily life, hook the abstractions, the dream work, into daily physical life. At some point, daily life becomes extreme light. Because you've gradually expanded through your energy body, and the more, and you've expanded your known world, you've expanded your energy. A natural byproduct of that is the physical world takes on a dream-like quality. Not that it shifts, not that it's random. It's just that it's more heightened. Dreaming, awake, and heightened awareness are synonymous terms. And so, colors are richer, sounds are sharper. Your experience is more intense, all good and bad. And so, you enter into more of a fluid, flexible arrangement with the physical world. And that catapults the person into yet new realms.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that any time you indulge in any deep spiritual endeavor, you might say, that is really contradictory to living a modern, normal life. And yet your bio indicates that you do have a normal, modern life.
Right.
You know, would you say that there isn't a conflict between the two?
No, not at all. The fact, the way I was taught was that if you cannot do it in your daily life, you really haven't learned anything. And so the strategies, there's some interesting strategies associated with that are totally applicable to daily life. Everybody has tension or frustrations. And say a person at work, they just really cannot stand, but they have to work with the person to advance the mission of the company.
Right.
Job at hand. So one of the strategies these Toltecs came up with, it was called the Petty Tyrant. And this was evolved out of the Inquisitions and the Indian Wars, when the Toltecs were subjugated.
Uh-huh.
And there was a concerted effort to wipe them off the face of the off the face of the earth, because they were the leaders of the Toltec nation some 5,000 to 7,000 years ago. And like any good, and then later and more, you know, last few hundred years, as any good invading army will do, they will try to neutralize leadership. And so the Spaniards and other Indian tribes sought to eliminate the Toltecs because they were leaders of the Toltec nation. And the Toltec shamans were the leaders, the political leaders. And so as a result of that, the remnant that survived went underground, revamped all the practices. They discovered they had been quite arrogant, so caught up in the marvels of their own thinking that they didn't even see an invading army come in. And that has dramatic parallel with global warming. Humans are so caught up in all their grandeur that they didn't even see major long-term shifts occurring human-made.
Well, it's not just in our climates. I mean, when you really look at the major long-term things, we have things that are just as profound as that army was over the horizon to the Toltecs, just over the horizon for us.
Yep, and so what they did was they came up with this petty tyrant so that, like the Spaniard and the army who would be working to subjugate them, and they would learn to adapt and respond and still remain out of sight and use that tension not to manipulate or command, but to awaken awareness and achieve more balance than before. And so that, from that strategy, you have an immediate real-world application of not condemning or condoning the people you really don't like, but kind of like using them to step outside of your normal reactivity to get to a point where you can accept. Because the bottom line is, when we get reactive, it's just because we're ticked off at somebody else, because that, whatever it is ticking us off, is in us. And so the object is to be
gotten our goat, as I would say.
Pardon me?
I don't know how many times over the last few months, though, I've told myself, you know, this doesn't matter, just let it go.
Yeah.
You know, and often that's how I get through, you know, dealing with these minor frustrations that could snowball together and create, you know, a personal avalanche. It doesn't matter. It's, you know, this too shall pass, you know?
And that's where the death as an advisor comes in handy, just to bring you back to those types of senses, like get real with the world. It's like, if I'm going to die, do I really want to waste all my time and energy moaning and groaning over something I really can't control? And if there's something I can do something about, then, well, you better jump on your little hobby horse and go about it, not you personally, but you. And so, you know, in terms of, you made an interesting point here just a second ago, if I can pull it back, just dealing with the world. So if you're in heightened awareness, if you're in dreaming away, it's more present-centered, it's more immediate, it's more be-here-now kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And so you have to trust your discipline and your connection with the world and the world to give you the right guidance, have your instincts firing correctly, have your intuition giving you the right signals, so that, in effect, you are preparing everything you need for survival 5 years down the road, but you're making all those adjustments out of the moment. So it's very sophisticated behavior.
Well, you know, it sounds like a, you know, a really fascinating concept. I mean, we have all these changes that we can see are lurking over the horizon. You have the things like, you know, everybody over the last year has been talking about the Mayan calendar ends in 2012 and the world is going to come to an end. Of course, I don't know how many times just in my lifetime I've heard the world is about to come to an end, but, you know.
Oh, I've got the right angle. It's going to come to an end midnight tonight. I have it on good authority, right?
Well, you know, yeah, you know, I have seen people do insane things because the world was coming to an end.
Yeah.
You know, and we hear about it on the news all the time. You know, and so to learn to live in the moment and simultaneously be prepared for the future is really a fascinating concept.
Mm. I think it's the only ball game in town anymore, and I'm not trying to suggest to anybody that I am there yet. I get there on occasion. I see glimpses of it. I live there for periods of time, and my goal is, personal goal, is to be able to get there 24/7. I have enough experience, glimpses of it, to where I know it's attainable. My teacher was there 24/7, and it's quite, I think it's a worthy goal, and it's just like you said, it's interesting, it's provocative.
Well, and, you know, it sounds like what you're talking about has been the goal for a number of very spiritual people that I've talked to over the last few years, because of the impending changes and events that various people, you know, have predicted, prophesized, however you want to put it, you know, even with what we know is coming,
right.
You have to be somewhat prepared. Yet at the same time, you do need to live in the moment, too. You can't go through life worried about what's going to happen on December 12, 2012.
Yeah, it's right, and that brings the matter to discipline, and there's strategies and tactics to train a person to do that. And at a certain point, the person needs to let go of their training, because that just starts getting into the way. So the training takes it to one stage, and you have to let go of your training to engage another stage. And then that takes you to yet another one.
Sort of take it and run with the ball, so to speak.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, it seems that more interesting a guest is, the faster the breaks do arrive. And it is time for our first break of the show. So do stay tuned to the Donna Shades on the Paranormal Radio Network. And we will be right back with our guest, Ken Eaglefeather. Welcome back. You're listening to the Donna Shades on the Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and I'm talking tonight with our guest, Ken Eaglefeather. I want to make sure that everyone knows, if you have a question for our guest tonight, you can call in toll-free in the United States at 1-877-786-0562. You can also join us in the virtual auditorium at www.paltalk.com, in the Paranormal Radio Network room in the Social Issues category, and raise your hand to ask a question from anywhere in the world. Our guest tonight, Ken Eaglefeather, also has his books available at www.innertraditions.com or at any bookstore, online, or brick and mortar. So, Ken, where were we? We were talking about your new book, the I lose my train of thought all the time. Well, the Inner Traditions website does say that your book, Toltec Dreaming, is a metaphysical instruction manual on the role of dreaming in the Toltec tradition. Now, for someone like me, that description is a bit mystifying, so how would you explain that statement in relationship to your book?
It was, everybody on the face of this earth has an energy body. It's the way we're created. Science is, each and every day, is bringing that fact more to life. The Toltecs are an ancient crowd of seers who have been working with directly with the energy body for centuries. And as you might be aware, you probably are aware, like the work of Fridtjof Capra, a few others, the Tao of Physics, Paul Davies' work, a few other physicists and metaphysicians are pointing the way to where the world of metaphysics and the world of physics or general science are coming together. And so in this regard, I was just at a conference where they had a polyinterference photography. It's a digital camera with a sophisticated software that actually, in real time, images where two waveforms intersect. And it measures the photons that are given off when those two meet. So it'd be like if I got close to you or you got close to a light bulb, the energy between the two would meet, and they give off photons from where they meet. And this technology tracks it, measures it, and you can see it. And so this is just an example of where science and technology is slowly coming to grips with what some crowds of people have been doing for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
And well, so, you know,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I'm not what I would consider a shaman or anyone who is even spiritually wise. Yet when I walk into a room where there's someone, you know, I do feel energy radiating from them.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be positive or negative or neutral.
Exactly. And so these ladies and gentlemen worked with that at a very professional level where they could learn to see energy, manipulate it, for both bad and good, actually. That was part of, they went through a cycle of reformation where they had to really address the ethical side of what they were doing because too many people were using their skills for greed and manipulation. And so, and again, it has a nice modern counterpart towards some of the corporate behaviors and political behaviors. So there's, in these ancient times, there's all nice modern correlates of ethics, of learning, of dealing with energy fields. And so the bottom line is that this energy field is natural to humans. The Toltecs have the Taoists, for example, and the people who gave us meridians, as well as the Hindus who gave us chakras, have been working with this for a long, long time. It's gradually breaking the seal and getting entered into daily consciousness around for mainstream folks, and rightfully so. I think my personal opinion is this should be taught in elementary school, just because not necessarily Toltec, but that we have an energy body and how that affects your daily life, your daily perception.
And but so at the same time, we do battle what I commonly refer to as the religion of science, which
yep.
is the most exclusionary thing imaginable.
Yeah, it is. It's the same. There's another nice core counterpoint in modern terms. It's, you have these people blinded by their own greed of knowledge, and if it doesn't fit into what's really interesting to me about scientists, and I know some sterling scientists, they're just top-end people, but in general, a lot of times the way it's practiced is not really the way it was meant to be practiced. It's an investigational tool to take you deeper and further and expand your horizons of knowledge, but then the focus of it has been on the physical world exclusively. And so that becomes almost like, well, that's the way the world is. That's scientific.
And scientific fact becomes as restrictive as the Middle Ages religious dogma.
Exactly.
And just as exclusionary. And if you don't fit into it, you're going to meet the Inquisition.
Yeah, right. Yes, exactly. And so, you know, that's the game afoot. And so it's a matter of, the bottom line is just on a daily basis trying to work with all the resources that present themselves.
Well, it's nice when the two come together, because the religion of science shouldn't be, as far as I can, you know, if I was, you know, ruling the world, I would say, no, this is not a religion, you know. Because science is, it's like the physical self, and we do need to remember that we also have a spiritual, non-physical self as well.
Right. And that's humanity. I mean, if you look, if you can imagine some extraterrestrials, anthropologists mapping us out, and they, what they will do is report to their university, equivalent of university, that this particular species, the dominant species of planet Earth, is part rational, part spiritual, and that they have not come to terms with that yet, so there are a lot of schizophrenic people walking around because they're denying aspects of their humanity. And they'll say, this is a really wild bunch, let's send some more to observe.
Well, you know, that is important, because living a life of duality where you keep your spiritual and physical self apart like squabbling children, you know, is that really all that healthy?
Pardon me?
It's really all that healthy to do that.
Oh, right.
You know,
to
separate the two sides of yourself. You know, aren't you going to be, like, causing some sort of, I don't know, physical repercussion as well as spiritual repercussion? I mean, it doesn't sound healthy. Rip it apart, two halves apart.
Right. I think they need to be separated, though, for the modern, for the person who's been groomed in the Western European philosophical model of reason. I think they need to be separated, but only to the point of recognition, and then in a true Hegelian fashion of reconciliation, if you will, to use a religious term, then you go to synthesize them. And that step is what's really lacking. And so we end up just keeping the separation and then living the separation rather than defining what we are and then integrating all aspects and then moving forward to yet a new level. We define the various aspects and then live in that separate domain, the domain of separateness. You know, that's how reason operates. It operates by subjective-objective reference. And so it automatically splits the world. It automatically removes you from the environment. And so, you know, global warming, again, is like a, is an effect of that. We don't even, we have become so removed from our environment that we don't even see the effects that we commit against the environment because of the, of that subject-object reference. And the shamanic traditions tend to reconcile that split of the individual as actually a part of the environment. And even science now is becoming very hip to that and is now defining the, you know, the human organism and the environment as part of the human organism. So things are, as things are on the horizon looking pretty grim, there's a lot of really good, cool stuff happening as well.
Well, I have to admit, I'm the perpetual optimist. You know, I always figure that somehow we're going to pull it out of the sack at that last minute and get it all together. You know, and it's sort of the thing that, you know, I always tell people, you know, you worry about your own little corner and spruce it up and you hope that it spreads like a virus. You know, that you know, we each, if each one of us works towards just sort of integrating our own self with our environment, with our climate, with our world, with our neighbor even, then, you know, things are getting a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. And it, you know, that, and going back to the energy body itself, though, part of the theory is that the shape of it determines what can go on within it. So it's gradually becoming more spherical over millennia, and that automatically lends itself to more balanced perception. So I think there's a lot of things that can be done in terms of looking at who we are, what's going on, how we make mistakes, how we learn, how we grow, and we haven't even begun to scratch the surface, and yet the arrogance in knowledgeable communities abounds. We were talking about a couple minutes ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you know, and there's nothing more frightening than someone telling you they have all the answers because you know you're in trouble.
That wasn't in my bio.
No, I wasn't meaning that you said you had all the answers.
I've got to talk with those people.
No, they didn't tell me that you were the big guru of all and you were going to save us all from ourselves.
Oh, man, now there's a marketing plan for you. There's a marketing plan.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and maybe spirituality suffers from a bad marketing plan. I mean, there isn't much money in it, but, you know, maybe they do need to market it a little bit more positive somehow.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, obviously, science has a marketing plan. You know, it might not be a real coherent it's not all, you know, integrated together and all one, but... You know, we get little bits and pieces of it from the pharmaceutical companies, from the plastic companies, from manufacturers, from food people, you know, even right down to what I'm drinking right now. You know, it's supposed to make me energetic and healthy and, oh, you know, faster. What is it? Faster, stronger, and something else. I keep bigger. I don't want bigger. They can leave bigger out. Okay, bigger days are gone. But yeah, you know, it's everywhere, you know, and perhaps, you know, we do need to think about marketing spirituality. I never thought of it that way before.
It's good. I mean, you're exactly right. There's a lot of money that goes into trying to confine people's perceptions along certain pathways so they'll behave in a certain way. In other words, buy a certain product or buy a certain belief system.
Well, many times I have sat and I've watched people go by, and mentally I'm sorting them. People, not people. People, not people. Not necessarily in those ratios, but we'll leave it there for now. And it's like, okay, the people are the ones who are aware that are independent of whatever. The not people are the ones that, okay, they got on the rat wheel, they have bought the plan, they are supposed to work to death, make sure they have lots of credit, spend all their money and next year's money too, buy that house, that new car every couple of years, have two kids, yada, 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 and then die happy campers without ever making any ripples in the world's waves. And the not people, you know, the people really do. They seem to be looking for something else. They seem to be exploring their spirituality, seem to be more awakened. You know, and you know, a lot of people look at me like I'm a little nuts when we tell them that, but I'm like, come on, come down in the French Quarter with me and watch this.
No, that's great, and I think perhaps with most of the work in the last couple decades has come from these traditions, such as Zen Buddhism, esoteric Christianity, Taoism, Hinduism, Toltec, Shamanism, and they're limiting because they appeal to only the certain personalities who resonate with their approach to going about it. And so I think a nice step would be, as part of this marketing plan you're pitching here, is to present it in a more mainstream concept. So the way people were raised in this Western European philosophical culture, they'll get it. They'll get more of it. The problem with that is there's always the abuses are so ready, and most there's a lot of you know, you mentioned spirituality. You addressed this at the beginning of the show. Everybody's going to come up with their own definition, and darn it, they'll be spiritual to the day's end, and they're going to fight you about it to show you they're right too.
Well, you know what? I've discovered people are not as apt to fight you over spirituality as religion.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's the truth. They really don't. Spirituality is much more neutral. It's much more unifying. Whereas religions can be separatist. I mean, each group, you know, is the best. Their God, you know, will beat my God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's kind of really a very strange approach to me, I guess. I just don't understand this. You know,
yeah, it's... The, you know, the three principal monistic religions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, they all have the common ancestor of Abraham. And so then, you know, they're producing quite a bit of tension throughout the world and jockeying for position on who's grandest, and yet they all descend from exactly the same forefather. And they all, you know, in essence, the same principles, and they're still going to figure out some way to duke it out.
Yeah, I find the whole concept of I'll kill you and that'll change your mind sort of bizarre.
Right.
Especially for religions that really advocate peace.
Yeah.
You know, it's a conflict that mentally I just don't get. But at the same time, I know very well that I can just in a few words manage to pick off almost every person in any religion. So I usually avoid that. So, getting back to a safer topic, you've also written some other books.
Yeah, to date, they've all been on some aspect of the Toltec philosophy, of which we've covered a bit of. My new work coming out next year with Inner Traditions deals pretty much with what we've been talking about. It presents the core of Toltec teachings, the energy body. But I've worked to place it in more of a mainstream perspective, and so I outline it in Western psychological terms of individuation, self-actualization, personal growth, ethics, closure, you know, basic psychological principles. But the idea being that we've got this thing, if it's natural to everybody, then everybody, I'm not trying to convert anybody, but I feel very strongly that everybody should at least be aware of it. And then what they want to do with that awareness is their business. And so the subsequent work, Ken Eaglefeather, he's written 5 books and he's not writing anymore. Kind of weird to talk about yourself in the third person. And then Kenneth Smith is the name that is moving forward now, which has the more, you know, mainstream flavor. And again, I'm not abandoning Toltec. I'm just pulling out the core, the energy body, documenting the viability of that concept with what's going on in science. And then I work through how that really works, what the dynamics are within it. If it's supposed to shape perception, how does it shape perception? And so that'll be out next year about this time.
Okay. Now I have a question from the virtual auditorium that came in text.
Okay.
And it's asked, does Ken believe in any kind of God?
Yeah, I do. Actually, quite firm in my conviction of a God. My God is both Hans Kuhn, a Catholic theologian, wrote a really marvelous book called Does God Exist?, where he tries to reconcile Catholicism, Buddhism, and a personal God, an impersonal God. And my version of a personal God is all of the above. From one angle, it's an impersonal God. From another angle, it's a very personal God. From one angle, it's a very it's an abstraction. And from another angle, it's something as immediate that's present with every footstep I take. And so I can't define God. I don't know what the heck God is. I just know that everything I've come up with is part of God. Or not that I myself came up with, but everything I deal with, everything I experience in life is of God. It's that being, he, she, it, is running the whole show, and the rules of that whole show I don't know, and it would be foolhardy to try to for me to define what those rules are.
Well, yeah, and, you know, anything you've said today, you know, when I've been talking to you, has not been contradictory or impossible to reconcile with any religion, at least that I know of.
Nope.
It doesn't conflict. There's no direct conflict. I mean, you could be both. You could be a Catholic or a Baptist or a Presbyterian. I don't know that much about Islam. I know more about Judaism. You know, you could be those things and practice this too.
Exactly. You're making a really wonderful point because it addresses my central theme that the energy body is universal. And so what we're dealing with is we're saying humans have two arms, two legs, you know, the normal human, the normal healthy human, a head, a torso, buttocks, all that kind of stuff. And we're saying now add on to that an extended anatomy. that every human, it's universal, has an energy body. And so when you're dealing with the core elements of that, it's no different than going to your personal physician for a checkup to see if your heart's still beating. That's what humans do. It's universal. And the person's heart is beating, whether they're a Christian, a Hindu, a Jew, or whatever. It's universal. So thank you for making that point.
Well, I really honestly don't see any potential for conflict. I mean, they all kind of go hand in hand, and, you know, it's just exactly like you said. It's like saying that your religion won't let you check on your physical health. You know, I'm sure somewhere there's a religion that just doesn't allow that, but there can't be that many, okay? You know, and so that it is a good idea to do those checks on your spiritual health.
Ah, right. Excellently run. Very well run. And that's where ethics come in. And that's where knowledge of stages and where you fit into the stages. A little bit of history. History can be perverted like anything else. But a little history, knowing that the Toltecs went through a reformation, as did the Christians, as did the Taoists. It seems like with any great tradition, there is an extended period, we're talking a couple hundred years, of the dark side. And then there comes a contingent who sits down and says, hey, wait just a second, you know, this is not good. We need to reform. We need to deal with the dark side and move out of it to what is intended. More of a God intention, if you will, more of a full meaning, bringing you more fully to life. I think part of God is also expansion and contraction. And so, just like the heartbeat, that's in each and every person, you have the heartbeat of God pumping. And so, growth is expansive, and we need to contract a little bit to make good our gains. Then we need to expand again. And it, you know, stretch the envelope, be a real Star Trekker and go where no person has gone before. Stop, contract, integrate it, see where we are, do our channel checks, do our ethical assessments, make sure we're on the right track to where it is we want to go, and then expand once again.
Well, rather like a physical training program, your spiritual training program works in sort of the same way. Don't overstep your bounds too fast or you can get a boo-boo.
Well, good point. And that just once again speaks, if you're dealing with trying to integrate the human, the physical is going to reflect the spiritual and vice versa, because you're dealing with as an integrated whole person. And so you've got all these, you know, human beings are really complex just in the physical system. When I was in grade school, they told us there was five primary systems, you know, the circulatory, respiratory, skeletal, muscular, nervous. And now, the last couple of decades, they've got the immune system, they've got signaling systems of these chemical messengers, and now they're taking that to an energetic intercellular level. And so the boundaries of what the human being, just even physically, is comprised of, all the barriers are getting knocked down. And exactly the same thing applies to spiritual development. I think all, my personal opinion is that all the major world's religion, all the metaphysical philosophies need to be sit down and looked at once again and revamped, because they've had, you know, a good 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 year run, depending on which one you're talking about.
And hang on to that thought there, Kim.
Pardon me?
I said hang on to that thought right there. It's now time for the top of the hour break, so please stay tuned, and the Donna Shades will return in just a moment on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Got me on a roll.
Welcome to the Donna Shades on the Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and I'm talking tonight with our guest, Ken Eaglefeather. Now, Ken's books are available at www.innertraditions.com or at any bookstore, online, or brick and mortar. I also want to make sure that everyone knows, if you have a question for our guest tonight, you can call in toll-free in the United States at 1-877-786-7777. 1-800-878-0562. You can also join us in the virtual auditorium at www.paltalk.com in the Paranormal Radio Network room in the social issues category. And raise your hand there to ask a question from anywhere in the world. Now, Ken, in the meantime, while we've been away, I did get a question from the virtual auditorium. And they wanted to know what your take is on Wicca.
Oh, interesting question. From my exposure to it, it's one of the oldest religions, and it's earth-based. So you're looking for harmony and balance between the humans and the earth. And then their practices and philosophies from that point on are as they are. And that's about as the extent I can address that.
Okay, so it's not in conflict, but it really isn't something that you've done a lot of research into.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. The little bit I've done, the participation, some friends I have that are Wiccans, or just reading a book or seeing somebody on TV addressing the topic. It's interesting. My personal preference is a little more abstract. I'm not a fan of ritual, not that that necessarily has to be part of Wiccan lifestyle, but I'm more drawn to abstractions and then finding another sense of balance from that. So that, just like we were talking before, all these different philosophies, traditions, religions achieve resonance. I think they're all of God, and I think people are drawn to them because they feel a connection and awakening by participating. And some do it forever, your entire life. Some of them travel a short, some a long distance, and they get awakened to a certain point, and that was a nice stepping stone. And so it could happen any way, shape, or form. And that's, it's part of the mix. And it's part of what helps, if it helps the person become a better person, more aware, and walk a little more gentle, graceful path on the face of this earth, then, as they used to say back in the 60s, far out, man.
Well, a lot of times I think what people really crave is the rituals themselves. Not only are they familiar, but it is a tool to focus the mind on, a desired, change in the world around them, or change in themselves, however you want to put it. But that ritual is what is craved.
Right. Yes, there is no doubt about it. Ritual is a very powerful practice. It has very powerful effects, and that's great. My own circumstances, of which I don't need to go too far here, just that in my upbringing I had ritual coming out of my ears. And,
okay. A lot of times I regard ritual as a crutch to help you get there, and if you don't need it, why use crutches?
Well, that's the other side of it. In modern psychology, for example, they have this term called dishabituation, where you're getting rid of your habitual responses. So you can be someone else, you can engage something, you can learn more, you can accelerate learning. And so rituals do both that. They take you out of your normal patterns, let you learn completely new patterns, but yet, in general terms, those new patterns need to be replaced. And so if you get locked into those rituals, you've just done exactly what you were doing before, except in a bigger and better dysfunctional way. So it's a very, that's part of the treachery of the path, of trying to grow to the be-here-now level. Everybody faces it that tries to walk that path, no matter the tradition they use. Everybody's going to fall flat on their face. And the people who actually make it are the ones who pick themselves up, keep walking out, sort it out, try to figure out what's ritual, what's this, what's meaningful, what's not, how long do I use it, when do I let it go. All those things need to be addressed. And the answers are all individual. The traditions can focus, can give you the tools, but if you don't summon your own resources and do it on your own, you're just, you're a fundamentalist. You're locked into that particular tradition.
Some people are so locked into the concept of ritual, or, you know, and in some cases it's habit. The ritual is a habit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a ritual even getting up in the morning. They brush their teeth, they comb their hair, they take a shower, you know, and they do everything in exactly the same order. They put their right sock on, their left sock on, their right shoe, their left shoe, and so forth and so on. And, you know, if you rock the boat of that ritual, it just ruins their entire day. Because they're definitely locked into that little ritual.
And in recognizing that natural tendency for humans to do that, Toltecs came up with the technique of altering routines, which, in Western psychology, is known as dishabituation, to where you actively do something different, like you'll put the opposite sock on, or put your belt on backwards, or you'll drive a different route to work each and every day. The interesting thing about that is sometimes the changing of habits becomes a very grand habit. And so you're driving to work a different route each and every day from a higher on to perspective. It's just another routine. So
yeah.
Once you recognize that, then the next maneuver, the next stage, is to get into your heart, get into your body, feel where you should drive. Maybe for a week you're going to do different things. Maybe for a week you're going to do exactly the same thing. But you change as needed, and you let your feelings, your intuition, your instincts become your primary guidance rather than the rote form of habit.
Well, that's an excellent thing. I mean, one of the most difficult things, I think, for me has been learning to listen to my own intuition, trusting myself. I do have another question from the virtual auditorium in text, and the question is, can he share some of his out-of-body experiences and how it opens one's mind or gateway to oneself?
Interesting. Okay, a couple of those. One time I found myself out-of-body, just sitting above my bed. The sheer shock of seeing my physical body laying snapped me right back into my body. That's a normal experience.
Uh-huh.
And so the technique to remedy that is when you find yourself suddenly, unexpectedly out of body, go do something. Now, at that point, people start getting afraid. I'm afraid I'm never going to get back to my body. Well, it's been my experience in talking with other people who had the opportunity to do such things. You're going to come back before you want to. Your bladder is going to get to such a level that you're going to come back because you have to go to the bathroom. And that's going to ruin a really good adventure. All of my experiences out of body have been positive and growth affirming. I flew to Mars one time, and I found that Mars was inhabited by geometric figures that lived, and that's the way I perceived them, lived in another dimension, more like an abstract dimension, the etheric field, if you will, of Mars. But they were the different species were different geometric forms, but they had the capacity to communicate. And so that was another, let's see. Oh, one time I flew back to Vietnam. That was rather poignant. I got sucked into a river on that one and pulled myself out. And that was just a lesson to leave. For me, that was just to leave the past alone. And so what happens is you, by virtue of participating with your life from a completely novel angle, and then having these different experiences, you learn more. You learn more what it means to be human, and you try to integrate that knowledge and find ways to enact it through a path, through some rigorous study, to move forward. So what happened, I know at the same time, as with any occupation, with any skill, it can be perverted. I know of some out-of-body practitioners who use it only so they can go out and have the experience of what's known as astral sex. I don't know that that's quite the right term for it, but that's what's in the literature. And they do it just to go bar hopping, if you will, which is kind of unsatisfying. I'd rather fly through the clouds myself.
I have another question. Were you using a natural process for the experiences or self-induced drugs such as DMT, which I'm not sure what DMT is?
Great question. I've never used DMT. And 98% of my out-of-body experiences have been self-induced with no psychotropic pharmaceutical agents. One time, I used peyote once, and we're talking, 30 years ago? And it was in the mountain, the Superstition Mountains of Arizona.
Ooh, I know them well.
And it was in an apple orchard with an abandoned cabin with a fireplace and a hearth inside the cabins where all the doors and windows had been knocked out of it. And so I ingested some peyote, and I had a bilocation experience, which is kind of like getting next level beyond ordinary, quote-unquote, ordinary out-of-bodies. And so I was standing with my physical body near the hearth, near the fireplace, and I found myself suddenly flying with at tremendous speed at night over the Superstition Mountains in my out-of-body form. And then I found I could control the process of shifting my perception to the out-of-body state or the physical state at will. So I came back and forth several times until it dawned on me that I had the capacity, that I could control the capacity. And then I made the mistake of eating some food and went up back out in the woods to throw up.
Yeah.
So I do not advocate the use of drugs whatsoever. I don't have any experience at all with the modern ones that are in contemporary culture. And I think they have a value of which our culture has not awakened to. At the same time, I'm personally pretty adamant they're medicine. And just like you wouldn't take penicillin unless you had an infection,
uh-huh.
The better route is not to take drugs unless you have an infection of the mind.
I know that my personal experience is I have seen many, many people coming in from ceremonies involving peyote, and it was actual ceremonies, and coming into the ER very sick.
Yeah.
Now, the official thing from their traditional religion was they essentially had a spirit sickness, and that's what caused the problem. But it required physical treatment.
Right.
Because they were not in very good shape.
Yeah, peyote.
Okay, I had some more questions, though, from the audience. And let's see, would you say it's the same as astral projection, this out-of-body experience?
Yes, and in a nutshell, yes. The term astral projection typically is related toward the ancient esoteric format where you have the cosmologies, there's the physical, etheric, astral, mental, causal realms of existence. And the higher ones and the more abstract and they influence the lower dimensions all the way down to the physical. That's one cosmology. In the mid-70s, the term, with the work between Charles Tart, a professor emeritus of psychology out at the University of California, and Robert Monroe, the fellow who wrote Journeys Out of the Body, they coined the term out-of-body because they were looking for a more neutral, quote-unquote, scientific term. And astral projection is biased simply because of the cosmology from whence it comes. The problem I have now is that out-of-body is subject to that same bias. I don't think we go out of body. We're always inside our energy body. We have a perception of perceiving the world not from our physical, but we're still in our body. We're still in our energy body. And so we're not opening ourselves to invasion by demons. We're not, if you want to come back, even if you don't have a full bladder, the only thing you have to do is like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz did, which was, by the way, a perfect portrayal of an out-of-body or an astral projection. And so, in the Wizard of Oz, you just click your heels together and you intend to come back to your physical body. There's no barrier. You're in yourself at all times. It's how you relate to that that may or may not produce any problems.
Okay. I have another question from the virtual auditorium, and that is, how do you know that your out-of-body experience is not a lucid dream, How do you differentiate between these two states of mind, lucid dreaming and out-of-body experience?
Yeah, another very great question. A lucid dreaming, by definition, is when you wake up inside your dream and you can control the dream. One exercise to go out-of-body is to have another dream within that dream environment. So let's say you're in lucid dreaming and you go to a house that you're very familiar with. You sit down in a chair. From that dream state, you go into yet another dream.
Uh-huh.
You kind of double charge your dream. And out of body is recognizable principally by kinesthetics, by the simple awareness of it. It is not, it's another category of dreaming, at least the way I outline it, but you know you're not in a lucid dream. You have more mobility, more clarity. You have more locomotive capacity. So when you move, another way of explaining it is when you're out of body and you move, you go to point A to point B, not unlike you do in the physical. When you get up and you leave and you go for a walk or run or drive, you go from point A to point B. In a lucid dream, you might have that sort of experience, but what really is occurring is you're shifting the landscape. If a monster's coming after you, you just will the monster to change into a puppy dog. Or if you want another dream environment, you just will it to change. Now, having said that, now stepping back from both of those positions, we get once again that that's what we're doing all the time. In another sense, it's all mind. We're not moving. We're only experiencing the perception of movement, no matter whether it's getting into your car, no matter whether it's having a lucid dream or an out-of-body. It's a shift of energy inside the energy body, which gives us a perception of movement, time and space occurring.
Which makes me start to wonder, you know, by willing it to be so, can we have an effect on our own physical body and our own physical environment?
Oh, I think the literature answers that very nicely. For example, in the yogi states, Hindu states, the fakir, F-A-K-I-R, that's the person who learned mastery over the physical body, laying on a bed of nails, contortions, things like that. Shapeshifters, they call them the skinwalkers out in the Midwest, Native Americans.
I've had experiences with those.
Who shapeshift, so that's exceeding control. And then the person who's learned how to heal themselves of a cold, an ulcer, a disease of any other form, performs another form of shape-shifting. And the problems, that I think that's fair game. Self-healing is totally fair game. It's when you use, when you learn you have those abilities and then you apply them towards untoward ends, not unlike any corporate environment. So the process of learning, the process of ethics is exactly the same. It's just
so it's
not
conceivable that a person could learn to look within their own body and look for malfunctions there and take action to repair them.
No question about it. I think that's what occurs in the placebo effect. And the company I work for now, we're actually one of our long-term projects, is to map out the placebo effect and a study and design of therapy that induces the response, at which time it's no longer placebo, it's an actual medicine. So there's a lot of scientific work aimed at exactly that, mind over matter, and I think there's ample documentation in cultures worldwide that say that is a natural ability of...
Well, I know in, we'll call it Western traditional medicine, which is the doctor, hospital, pharmaceutical company that we normally deal with, there's been a lot of recent stuff on integrating traditional belief systems, especially in terms of immune health services, with the modern medical treatment, because they found that it worked better.
Right.
And it's a more holistic view of treating the body. You know, combining the traditional belief system and their spirituality with the physical effects of what they were treating them for.
And then you bring it back to that the humanity is part science, part spiritual, and it's the integration that lends itself to health and healing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have another question from the virtual auditorium, and it is, what about mind over matter or telekinesis? And we are about 30 seconds from break. So, we are going to wait on the answer to that, because it definitely seems like the more interesting a guest is, the faster the breaks are up. And it is time for that last break of the show. So, do stay tuned to the Dawn of Shades on the Paranormal Radio Network, and we will be right back with our guest, Ken Eaglefeather.
Now, these are really good questions.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Dawn of Shades on the Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and I'm talking tonight with our guest, Ken Eaglefeather. Ken's books are available at www.innertraditions.com or at any bookstore online or brick and mortar. I also want to make sure that everyone knows if you have a question for our guest tonight, you can call in toll-free in the United States, 1-877-786-0562. You can also join us in the virtual auditorium at www.paltalk.com in the Paranormal Radio Network room in the Social Issues category, and raise your hand to ask a question from anywhere in the world. Now, we're in the last half hour of the show, so it's definitely your last chance, and we've got some questions already lined up, too. So while you're thinking about that question that's driving you crazy, I did have a couple of things to remind you of. We were giving away something during shows during the remainder of the month. So make sure that you read the website, www.giascott.com, and send in your survey. The questions are at the bottom of the first page. I'm known for being just a little bit sneaky, so be prepared if you want to be the one that wins. So, Ken, we had a question that I read to you just before we went on break, which was, what about mind over matter or telekinesis?
Again, I don't think there's any question, even in the scientific literature, that occurs. There are PK, psychokinesis, is one major branch of extrasensory perception, or I should say psychic ability, psi, italify, PSI.
Uh-huh.
ESP, extrasensory perception, and psychokinesis are the two major branches. Under ESP, you have like telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, or being able to foretell the future. And under PK, you have things such as out-of-body, mind over matter, bending spoons, imprinting images on photographic film. Russell Targ and Harold Pudoff, both physicists, did some interesting work a number of years ago in that realm where they were disenchanted with their normal studies, and they decided to use their scientific acumen to study psychic functionings. There's also a one-week workshop at the Monroe Institute in the hills of Virginia, where one of the things they do, the participants learn how to bend spoons. And I've seen the handiwork more than one time. So I think the psychic abilities are, again, of our nature. They can be accounted for by different models, scientific and metaphysical. And I think it's all part of the package. The East Europe and Russia tend to be light years ahead of American scientific research. Back in the 70s, there would be international conferences. The American scientists, and this is no derogation intended, would show up scratching their head. Hey, do you guys think this psychic stuff is real? And their Soviet counterparts would respond, well, sure it is. And we're trying to figure out how to harness it. And so just that one, just the manner of approach determined subsequent research.
Okay, now I have another question from the virtual auditorium, and it sort of starts off with a little bit of a comment, and it talks about alien abductees recently moving deeper into spirituality as an attempt to take control of the events happening to them, but that at the same time, you know, how can it stop abductions any more than religion? But it more would be sort of a way to keep your mind busy. What is your take with spirituality in terms of alien abductions? Or do you have anything to say about it at all?
I've had, when I was a subject, the research subject in the laboratory at the Monroe Institute, I had a number of experiences which were categorized as extraterrestrial intelligence contact. And out of that, the abduction phenomenon, which I have no doubt might be occurring, it's not like an out-of-body, because it's an external force. It's no different than a scientist gathering mice and rabbits in a laboratory, another species, for their own purposes. So it's not in the same category as lucid dreaming and out-of-body, of which is an internal process. It's an external species investigating in a manner no different than human scientists investigating. And so it is documented that individual spirituality tends to become more to the forefront during periods of stress. Not only as a way to handle the stress, but as a way to seek answers and actively better govern one's own life. And so out of stress, for example, out of horrific circumstances, comes the roots of spirituality, comes the roots of psychic functioning, actually. A lot of the best psychics had really horrible childhoods. And the expression, the latent expression of psychic ability was a result to come to terms with that, and no different than in an abduction experience. I do think sometimes the abduction is translated incorrectly. That what's occurring is translated in terms of what is thus far known about the experience. And, you know, I've seen flying saucers come out of thin air, just start to come right out of thin air. So I do think there is an extraterrestrial contingent visiting Earth and has been for a long, long time. And then from that, the debate will continue until they show up on the White House lawn, just like in the movie.
I don't anticipate them showing up on the White House lawn anytime soon. But basically what you're saying is that the human spirituality would be a way of dealing with the stress of the abduction, but in fact probably wouldn't have any more effect on the physical experience of abduction than it would have on any other physical experience.
I don't know if I can go that far, because by virtue of realigning yourself with life, realigning yourself with your life, you might remove yourself out of that experience. So it might, I think a real honest look at the phenomenon, and not just calling people who are claiming to be abducted nuts or crazies or some kind of neurotic or psychotic people, but actually listening to them, finding the common denominators, of which some work has been done, but really taking a good, honest, scientific look at it and seeing what happens, see what the parameters are, see how people respond to it, see what's working, see what's not. It's just too new, and it's lack of a really genuine effort to examine the phenomenon that has probably produced a ton of misinformation.
Okay. And we have another question from the virtual auditorium, and it was whether or not the guest had made any contact with entities or beings, and was communication established, and by what source, such as ESP, or speak through the thought process only, or was it verbal contact?
Any entities? Are we talking about ETs or any entities?
Any entities, be it a spiritual entity, whatever name you want to tag on them, a ghost, whatever.
Yeah, well, ghosts, in those environments, both physical and out-of-body, it usually is kinesthetic, somewhat telepathic, if you will, more of a recognizing, a sensing of which there's a verbal sense to it, but nobody's verbalizing anything. It just gets the feelings get translated to that sense of things. The geometric forms I met on Mars, their communication, which was intentional, in the same way we're having an intentional conversation. But I would experience it in my body, and then my body would make sense out of it as best it could in my terms in relation to another species, and then I would ask questions, and I would get answers related to the question back. but it was all done like on an energetic level, and then the body would translate the energy into a sense of knowing what's happening. A couple ghosts I've seen, same process. All the interdimensional stuff seems to have occurred that way.
How about physical entities on this planet, you know, such as plants, trees, rocks, whatever?
For the most part, the same way. Communications, yeah, it's the same way. It's energetic and my body translates it. I remember in Tucson when I was out for a hike, I came across a cactus that was nervous as you can imagine. It was really different because I've never experienced a cactus that was just simply that nervous. The next day I went back to check it in the daylight, and lo and behold, 3 feet from it is where a bulldozer had stopped where they were cutting a pathway.
You know, I have to admit, okay, I used to spend a lot of time in the Apache Sitgreaves Forest in Arizona, up on the Mogollon Rim, and when they would go in logging, when you would go around the trees, ponderosa pines have a distinct aroma. Some people say it smells like chocolate, some people say it smells like vanilla. But after the loggers had been in the area, then it would smell different, like a fermented, odd smell. It was like the trees were nervous.
Yeah.
You know, it had a physical effect on the trees, even though those trees had not been damaged by the logging process, because of the logging occurring in the area. And it kind of, you know, and this was years ago, probably 10 years ago at least, that I first noticed this, and I was like, whoa, you know, the trees, they seem to have some sort of awareness. And how can this be? You know, trees don't have a brain. They don't have a central nervous system. How can they be aware of what's going on around them?
If you look at a tree, the roots in the, like bare trees in the winter, doesn't it look just like the nerves branching out?
Yeah, it kind of does.
I kind of look at leaves or trees as our as the nervous system of the planet. They pick up on what's occurring everywhere. And will inform humans. The ancient shamans did exactly that. They let the trees inform them of who was coming, what was happening, and what, and thereby they could determine what they needed to do.
Uh-huh. So. Yeah, I guess, you know, when I think about it that way. I have another question from the virtual auditorium. It's, what scientific tests have you done with regards to proving out-of-body experience? Have you ever set up two people going into this state and have them try and meet each other on another plane, then when they come back, verify, compare the information?
I've done it even where they've met in the physical world in a specific physical room and come back and have had similar reportings, recognized the locations of the other people in the room where it was not plotted out beforehand,
uh-huh.
And the other person would confirm that that's where they had placed their awareness. I did some work in a laboratory where I actually helped the person into an out-of-body state. I don't do that work anymore. And there was another one where we targeted a certain destination where I was just given coordinates and I had to tell what the environment of those coordinates. So I've done some of those things. And it got to the point where I was convinced it was real. Others were, and I'm going like, I want to go to something else. I want to grow beyond that.
Uh-huh.
And so now I'm trying to use dreaming to... I use it a lot for writing, actually. It allows the writing to come together, and then I just wake up and put...
I can relate to that because, you know, and everybody's heard this expression, let me sleep on it, when you're confronted with a problem.
Right.
And I go to sleep, and I run through various scenarios on how to fix the problem, whether it was, you know, a broken faucet, whatever the problem was, you know, whether it's interpersonal relations or whatever. You go through these scenarios, you try out various methods, and when I wake up in the morning, I know how to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I would call that a spiritual event, but it's a very useful one for me.
As practical as the day is long.
Yeah, you know, it would. You know, I've used it many, many times. You know, even dealing with my kids' issues as they were growing up. You know, you're like, okay, how do I deal with this? Because as we all know, kids don't come with owner's manuals. And so you try out these scenarios and come up with the best solution.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe spiritualism needs to be a little bit practical too, you know, to make it more personal.
One of the shamanic teachers of a couple decades ago used to say, if it doesn't grow corn, what good is it?
Well, yeah. Yeah, you know, I guess I could see where, you know, spiritualism really does kind of need a practical. And maybe that's the problem with some religions is, you know, you're not supposed to expect anything good now. It'll all happen after you die. And some of us are just not, you know, we need more immediate effects, perhaps. I do have another question, whether or not the government is using this technology for their own purpose, such as spies.
That, if somebody wants to do some research on that, check out a book called The Stargate Chronicles by Joseph McMonagall. The paperback version of the same book is Memoirs of a Psychic Spy.
Uh-huh.
McMonagall was literally remote viewer 001 in a top-secret U.S. Army psychic spy program where he, as he details, he found the Soviet Typhoon-class submarine and said where it was being built and what the dimensions of it were. Everybody says, no, that can't be. And he said, this is when it's going to be launched. He was off by 3 days, but darned if the world's largest nuclear missile-carrying submarine was launched within that by the Soviets in that area with those dimensions. And the Soviets are now, it's my understanding, the Soviets are continuing that work, and the Americans have backed away from it. So that book will aptly document government work in that regard.
No, they don't have a government program going currently to find out where bin Laden is.
I couldn't answer that. That brings in a whole... That brings a whole host of political and military questions when you say something, when that question is brought up.
Yeah, and I could see where a project such as that would not be public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's bin Laden or anybody else. You know, the when you really think about the possibilities of out-of-body travel, remote viewing, being able to alter your own environment, to be able to heal yourself, I would think that government, especially military, would be very interested.
Oh, I'm sure. Somewhere there are people actively investigating this for...
Okay, we have someone in the virtual auditorium that has raised their hand. So I'm not even going to try to pronounce this. INT, if you want to come to the mic, give your first name and your location, and you are live and on the air. Oh, they dropped their hand. Okay. There they are. Now they're there again. Okay, let's come to the mic, give your first name and your location, and you're live and on the air with Ken Eagle Feather.
Sure, I definitely see the possibility. I believe Joe may have outlined that scenario and actually work being done on both sides, both as an initiative and a counter-terrorism initiative. I don't know if it's still going on, but it has been actively pursued at one point, and I believe he might have outlined that in that same book. And Joe, again, he's a, you know, like he was... state-of-the-art. He was a field intelligence operative before they recruited him to do his psychic work. And he's a regular James Bond 001. So I suggest looking up his work. The hardback is Stargate Chronicles. Stargate was the project name, the code name. And the paperback, the trade paperback of the same book, is called Memoirs of a Psychic Spy, Joe McMonagle. I think that'll answer your questions and a lot more to boot.
Okay, well, folks, we are reaching the end of the show. So one more time, to get Ken Eaglefeather's books, you can go to www.innertraditions.com or any bookstore and find his books. And I hope you have enjoyed this show as much as I have tonight. Remember to tune in next week for our guest, Linda Drake. Also, this week I will be appearing on The Voice of the People from 8 to 10 p.m. on Saturday on the Paranormal Radio Network. November Hansen and I will be doing a show on the prophecy in poetry. I hope you all have a fantastic week and find that glimmer of light for your own personal illumination in this life. Tune in again next week for the Dawn of Shades with me, Tia Scott, as your host. In the meantime, have a great night.